Robert Stark. I am joined here with Ron Unz. He is running for the U.S. Senate in California. Ron Unz, it's great talking to you.
Hey, great to be here.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Alex von Goldstein.
It's great to be on, and especially with you, Ron. I'm a huge fan of your site.
Oh, thanks a lot.
You have been in politics quite some time. You ran for governor back in the 90s, and you also sponsored a ballot initiative to end bilingual education in California. Can you talk about a little bit about your political background and what inspired you to run for Senate this time?
Oh, well, I mean, I've been actively involved in public policy and to some extent politics now for really almost 25 years. As you mentioned, I originally mounted a challenge to the renomination of Governor Wilson in his Republican primary back in 94 because I was very unhappy with what he was doing. I didn't expect to win, and, you know, I did a pretty good showing. I got just over a third of the vote, which, you know, is difficult for somebody who nobody had ever heard of in the state a few weeks before the election. Now, in terms of this race, what spurred me to get into this U.S. Senate contest in California is that in 1998, I organized and sponsored a ballot initiative to pretty much get rid of bilingual education in California. In other words, to ensure that all the immigrant children in the state were taught to read English, write English, and speak English as quickly as possible once they entered school. The initiative was very heavily opposed by the political establishment in California, both Democrats and Republicans. We were opposed by the chairman of the state Republican Party and the chairman of the state Democratic Party. President Bill Clinton came out to campaign against us. We were opposed by nearly every newspaper, every union. We were outspent on advertising 25 to 1. And yet, despite that, we won one of the biggest landslides in California history with 61% of the vote. And once the initiative passed and the schools switched from Spanish almost only instruction to English, the results really were excellent. In other words, very quickly, millions of students learned how to read and write and speak English without any problem. Their parents were happy. Their teachers were happy. Everything was going fine. And, in fact, the newspapers which had opposed our initiative ended up sending reporters into the classrooms to see the results of this dramatic change in public policy. And the results were so successful that all the news stories that came back were absolutely glowing. And there was a front page story in the New York Times a couple of years later about the tremendous success of the program. The founding president of the California Association of Bilingual Educators became a born-again convert to English immersion and said that he'd been wrong for 30 years. English worked, bilingual education didn't work, and, you know, everything was fine. The issue was so thoroughly settled that for 10 years now it's been totally dead and forgotten in California. In other words, all the students are taught English, they all learn it, everything's fine, and almost nobody even hears the term bilingual education anymore. And then for reasons that only they can understand, the state legislature, including both the Democrats and the Republicans, got together and decided to repeal this proposition from 17 years ago and reestablish bilingual education in California. And, you know, I mean, that really irritated me so much.
Did they do this with – this wasn't a ballot initiative. Did the state assembly vote on this?
Well, no. The way it works is we passed a ballot initiative to get rid of bilingual education, so the state legislature doesn't have the power to overturn it. What they ended up doing was putting a ballot measure of their own on this November election to repeal Prop 227 and reestablish bilingual education. So, in other words, the voters will be deciding on whether to repeal our initiative this November. And, you know, at the time that happened, I really just was very irritated. But since the vote was going to be in November of this year, there wasn't really much I could do. And then as time went by and I, you know, was less tied up on other things, a couple of months ago, I really started thinking how to organize a campaign to keep 227 in place and defeat the repeal effort. And it seemed to me, you know, as I thought about it, entering the statewide U.S. Senate race might be a very good way to focus attention on it. Now, what you've got to understand is California has become virtually a one-party Democratic state. The Republicans are very weak. And in fact, the two Republican candidates who were running for the U.S. Senate were tied at 3% in the polls each, and neither of them had raised any significant amount of money whatsoever. So, you know, under those circumstances, it seemed to me that if I got into the race, I would have as good a chance as any Republican, and that would give me an opportunity to move my issue forward, and that's exactly what's happened. In other words, until a month or two ago, virtually nobody in California was aware of this attempt to repeal 227 and reestablish bilingual education. And now it's being widely discussed in the media, among ordinary voters, and as time goes by, it'll be even more discussed. And meanwhile, by entering this race, I've got a chance really to talk about a lot of important issues that I felt strongly about for 10 or 20 years. And there's even some chance I might make it past the primary and make it into the general election against the Democrat, Kamala Harris, and that would give me an even better platform. So, I mean, so far, you know, I'm somebody who's very interested in public policy. Being able to spend a couple of months discussing public policy and presenting my views in the media and also helping to prevent the repeal of Prop 227 seemed like a very worthwhile effort, and that's what I'm doing right now.
I think a lot of your ideas, like, they could appeal to a lot of people across the political aisle. Even a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters would like your ideas about raising the minimum wage, free university education. But a lot of people, they just see, like, an R next to your name, and they automatically write you off. The way California works now, they change the primary system. So instead of a party primary, there's just an open primary where you vote for the top candidates instead of the candidates by the party. Why did you choose to run as a Republican instead of an independent, since there is a lot of people just, like, flat out won't vote Republican?
Well, I mean, you've raised a good point. The truth is I've always been a Republican, and I really, you know, since it's difficult for anybody to other than one of the Democrats to win this election, I don't see much reason to change my party just to run in this U.S. Senate race. Also, though you're saying, what you're saying is totally correct. In other words, it's difficult for a Republican to win in California, but I would say it's impossible for an independent to even get to the November ballot, because the way it works is the top two vote-getters are on the November ballot. And if you're an independent, you won't get many Republicans to vote for you, and you won't get many Democrats. So there's virtually no chance whatsoever you'll come in second and will end up being on the November ballot. So by being a Republican, you know, I think I can get a lot of Republican support. I think I can get some crossover independent and Democratic support. And I do think I have a reasonable chance of doing well enough to be on the November ballot.
There is kind of this debate about where the Republican Party should head, whether they should return to conservative principles or be more centrist. And this article just came out in the San Francisco Chronicle about you saying even Republicans swing left in first California U.S. Senate debate. But the key issue isn't so much like centrist versus conservative. It's about being liberal or conservative on the right issues. There is a sort of bad type of centrism, which I think of as kind of like the establishment. But I was looking over your platform, and I was thinking, like, yeah, this makes sense. It's sort of the way I was thinking to myself, these are kind of like combining the best aspects of, like, Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, with maybe even a little bit of Ron Paul thrown in.
Oh, well, that sounds good. I mean, the whole thing about it is, as I've been saying to everybody, it's just difficult for a Republican or really a non-Democrat to win in California. To give an example, no non-Democrat has won a U.S. Senate race in California in 28 years. Sometimes they spend millions or tens of millions of dollars and get blown out of the water. Most people think this will be a bad year for Republicans overall in the country and probably in California, so that makes it doubly difficult. And under those circumstances, my point of view is just to say exactly what I believe on all these issues, to be very candid. And to the extent that, you know, on some of these issues I'd be considered more liberal, on some of them more libertarian, and on some of them more conservative, I mean, that's fine with me. And I'd hope that enough people agree with me on enough of these issues and also respect the fact that I'm candid, that I'll have at least a reasonable shot at coming in second and making it to November.
Have you gotten a lot of support from the California Republican Party and the California Tea Party?
Well, I really haven't been active in California Republican politics for really 15 or 20 years, since the early 2000s. Now, I'm actually quite friendly, or, you know, at least I was in the past quite friendly, with a number of prominent Republicans who are very, you know, active in the party. And many of them are still prominent Republicans, very active in the party. So, you know, I've been trading emails with them, talking with some of them on the phone, telling them what I'm planning to do. And, you know, it's not the sort of thing where they necessarily support me on all of these issues, but, I mean, they respect the fact that I've taken some strong positions in this campaign and in the past. And I think some of them do think that I probably have a better chance of doing well in this race than some of the other candidates. And, in fact, one of the nice things is, even though I was a very late entrant into this race, I actually filed my papers to qualify for the ballot on the absolute last day of filing. And there are a couple of other Republicans, in fact, several Republicans, who've been running for almost a year. And when the first poll came out, I ended up actually being in first place, though only by one percentage point. And there has been a more recent poll that shows me even in a stronger position. And part of that is because, you know, in the past, I really had been a very prominent Republican when I won the 227 campaign. And, you know, I've been involved in some issues since then. So some of it is residual name ID. But, I mean, the bottom line is most of the prominent leaders in the California Republican Party, I think, would be perfectly happy if I ended up doing well enough to make the November race. And it's not that they would probably come out and endorse me. And it's not that they would make a huge effort to have me be the successful Republican. But I think they'd be perfectly satisfied if I were. In other words, they agree with me on some issues. They disagree with me on other issues. But they do see why I might be able to have a broader appeal to non-Republicans, which is absolutely essential in California if a Republican has any chance of winning.
Well, where do you in the Republican Party in California see eye to eye, and where do you differ with them?
Okay. Well, I mean, it really depends. The Republican Party in California has a lot of different groups and factions, as you can imagine. You know, the more conservative Republicans, the more liberal Republicans, the more libertarian Republicans. On a lot of issues, I probably would generally be more on the conservative side. And, you know, sometimes those aren't really issues I focus that much on, but, you know, I'm generally regarded as a conservative. Probably the single issue where I would differ the most from most of the other Republicans in California that have told me that is I very strongly support a large increase in the minimum wage. And that's an issue I've been involved in now for 4 or 5 years pretty heavily. Most of the Republicans tend to disagree with that, though over the years I've actually won over some prominent Republicans to my side. Like, for example, Phyllis Schlafly has endorsed a big rise in the minimum wage. Mitt Romney ended up endorsing the minimum wage. Rick Santorum, Tim Pawalty, a prominent economic writer at National Review. And, you know, a few years ago, none of these people would have supported a higher minimum wage. And I think it's been largely my arguments that have helped, you know, directly or indirectly win them over. But still, given that, there are a lot of Republicans, prominent Republicans in California, who think a higher minimum wage is, you know, a very misguided idea. And that probably would be the single issue where I'd be most out of step with the Republican Party. But, you know, on the other hand, it's a very, very popular issue in California.
Mm-hmm.
And so even a lot of the Republicans who might disagree with me might think it might be a good idea for the Republicans to be seen as supporting it so that they'll get votes from Democrats and independents.
Do you think that the minimum wage should be adjusted on a local base level? Because, say, if you live in San Francisco, the Silicon Valley, or even L.A., then absolutely the minimum wage has to be at least $15, if not more, to adjust for the cost of living. But what if, in a, say, a place that's like really a lot cheaper, like Bakersfield, should it be adjusted for cost of living, or would you support a raise just everywhere?
Well, I agree with you 100%, and that's why I did not really agree with the $15 an hour minimum wage that Governor Brown recently signed. I had been proposing a $12 minimum wage in California. I would think 13, maybe even 14 would be all right, because just as you say, I mean, 15 has been fine in San Francisco, it's fine in LA, it's fine in Silicon Valley, but just is too high for the Central Valley. It will cause economic dislocations. So probably what I would have supported would have been a statewide, say, $13 an hour minimum wage. But then with Los Angeles, San Francisco, and certain other places probably having $15. And, you know, given the fact that the existing minimum wage was so low, it was only $10 an hour, on balance, I'm glad Governor Brown signed the $15 an hour bill. But I think it would have been better off at, say, $13 or $14. And on the federal level, for exactly that reason, I would support $12 an hour rather than something as high as $15.
Okay. What do you think the effects nationwide would be if, you know, let's say that Sanders, I mean, it doesn't seem like it would happen, but if Sanders was elected and somehow managed to raise the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour, what do you think the effects of that would be?
Well, I mean, the problem is there are many states, especially, say, in Appalachia or the South, you know, Mississippi and Alabama, where $15 an hour is so much higher than the typical lower-end wages, it would cause very massive job loss. In other words, when you have a minimum wage that's too far out of whack with the cost of living, you really have economic problems. And that's why, for example, many opponents of the minimum wage say, well, if you believe in the minimum wage, why not raise it to $50 an hour, $50 an hour? That way everybody will be successful. And the problem with that is you'd have massive, massive unemployment. So, you know, just as, for example, if you're desperate for dying of thirst, you need some water, that's fine. But, you know, if somebody pours a gallon of water down your throat, you'll probably die. And, you know, you just have to look at things on a practical level. You have to do studies. And you have to decide what the minimum wage should be. And I think probably something in the range of $12 an hour nationwide would be fine. And, you know, once we implement it, we can see what happens in different parts of the country and maybe adjust it.
One argument I've heard put out is that raising the minimum wage is kind of a politically correct way to reduce illegal immigration.
Oh, exactly. In fact, that's one of that really was one of the innovations I brought to the whole debate. And that's actually what originally brought me into the minimum wage issue, since I never really focused much on economic issues before. You know, there really has been a problem with illegal immigration in the country for quite a long time. And, you know, illegal immigration right now is fairly low, but it's been very high in the past, and it might be very high again in the future. And it's very difficult to deal with the illegal immigration issue, because, in a sense, when all the studies show that the vast majority of illegal immigrants come to America for jobs. They come here to get jobs. And all the politicians correctly say illegal immigrants take the jobs that Americans refuse to take, which is true. But the reason Americans won't take those jobs is the wages are just too low. In other words, the only people who are desperate enough to take those very badly paying jobs are recently arrived illegal immigrants. And that's the jobs magnet that draws in illegal immigrants. So if you raise the minimum wage to something reasonable, like $12 an hour in around the country, or say $15 an hour in San Francisco, $15 an hour in Los Angeles, what you'd end up with is a situation where very many more American citizens or immigrants who are already here would take those jobs. And once the job opportunities disappeared, fewer illegal immigrants would be drawn to the country, and it would be much, much easier to enforce our immigration laws. In other words, if you get rid of the jobs magnet, it's much easier to hire a few extra border patrolmen and make sure that there's much less illegal immigration. One other point I should make is that enforcing immigration laws is very difficult because hiring an illegal immigrant is in some sense a victimless crime, and it's hard to enforce victimless crimes. The employer can say, well, I looked at his documents and they seem genuine to me, even if they really were obviously fake. On the other hand, enforcing minimum wage laws is much, much easier. It's harder for an employer to say, oh, I forgot to pay my worker the legal amount I had to. And juries are much less sympathetic to employers who don't pay their workers what they're legally entitled to. So if we had strict enforcement laws on the minimum wage, I mean, including, for example, if somebody really hired a lot of people under the table at below the minimum wage and flouted the law, if they were given a prison sentence, a stiff prison sentence, I think the number of employers violating minimum wage laws would drop to almost nothing. And the nice thing about enforcing those laws is all the liberals and all the Democrats and all the unions would be 100% in favor of very harsh penalties for businesses that violate minimum wage laws, whereas they'll fight to oppose all of these restrictions on who you can hire if he's an immigrant. I think the higher minimum wage is the best and most effective means of reducing illegal immigration.
You were a strong opponent of Pete Wilson's Prop 187, which would have denied benefits to illegal immigrants. And you mentioned that back then you were much more pro-immigration, but your views have changed on that issue because you said that you think that even legal immigration should be decreased because of issues with unemployment and population growth. Can you talk about how your views on immigration have changed since then? I know your website doesn't necessarily reflect you. You have different other people writing for you, but I generally get the impression that the writers for UNS.com generally have kind of a immigration restriction leanings.
Sure. I mean, the truth is the writers I have on my website reflect a lot of different views, and what I focus on typically are views that are outside the media mainstream. In other words, on the right, on the left, on the libertarian side, people whose voices are not heard in the regular media, in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times. So, you know, a lot of those writers don't necessarily have views close to my own, and they disagree with each other a lot. But it's true. I've always been very strongly pro-immigrant, and that was most obvious when I was a very strong opponent of Prop 187 in California and Pete Wilson's effort to pass it. And I still consider myself very pro-immigrant today. But there's a difference between being pro-immigrant and being pro-immigration. As an example of that, one of the strongest opponents of immigration for years, for a couple of decades in the country, was actually Cesar Chavez, you know, the leading Latino activist. He was a very strong opponent of illegal immigration because he felt illegal immigration hurt the workers that he was representing. And so from my perspective, if we were talking 20 years ago, I really thought immigration levels were fairly reasonable. And back then, there didn't seem to be much sign of immigration hurting the economic interests of Americans, because most of the Americans, for example, in California, who were terribly hurt by the recession of the early 1990s, were hurt because of the collapse in aerospace spending, in military spending due to the end of the Cold War. So in other words, if they lost their jobs at Lockheed or at Boeing or at defense contractors, that had nothing to do with immigration. But over the last 15 years, I've really been surprised that immigration has stayed very high. Very high. In some ways, it's even gotten higher than it was 20 years ago. And I've seen more and more evidence that immigration has really started to drastically hurt American workers, including existing immigrants in the country. In other words, it drives down wages dramatically. And so for that reason, plus the fact that, you know, the very rapid growth of immigration has caused the population of California to increase by 150% since I was born in Los Angeles in the early 1960s. So for that reason, I really think we have to sharply reduce immigration right now. And as I said, illegal immigration, as it happens right now, is fairly low, though it might rise in the future. But what's very high is legal immigration. So my main position on that is that we have to sharply reduce legal immigration for a period of time until we see what happens to the economic situation. In other words, if workers seem to be doing much better economically a bit down the road, then I could see maybe increasing legal immigration again. But for now and for a period of years, I think we really have to have sharp cuts in legal immigration. And the main reason we have to guard against illegal immigration is that if we cut legal immigration by, say, I don't know, 40 or 50 or 60%, we have to make sure that it isn't compensated for by a rise in illegal immigration. So, yeah, I think we definitely have to cut immigration right now by a very substantial amount.
You have a background in the tech industry. What are your thoughts on the H-1B visas?
Well, on that, first of all, the number of H-1B visas isn't really all that large compared to overall immigration. I think it's something like 50 or 80,000 a year, and overall immigration is 1.3, 1.4 million a year. But one thing I have read about, and it's not something I focused a tremendous amount on, but there have been a series of articles in the New York Times and elsewhere that have made a very strong case that there's a tremendous amount of what might be called immigration fraud in H-1B visas. In other words, H-1B visas were intended to allow companies to bring to America individuals of extraordinary capabilities and benefits that would help our country. And they were explicitly restricted from being used to just undercut the wages of American workers in the industry. But it seems a lot of these companies are committing fraud, like Disney and other companies are hiring large numbers of H-1B workers. They then are using those workers to replace American workers that have sometimes had jobs for 10 or 15 or 20 years in the tech industry, in computers, and therefore drive down the wages of American technology workers. And that's very wrong. In other words, I'm not necessarily saying we should reduce the number of H-1B visas, but we should dramatically change the system so that it prevents H-1B workers from driving down the incomes of American workers and replacing them in their jobs.
I have a question that's related to a little bit ago. I was watching a presentation you did with Jason Richwine a couple years ago. About illegal immigration and crime. And
sure.
I think a lot of people, especially in the last year, have begun to focus on crimes committed by illegal immigrants. So I was just wondering, if you could just give a recap of your views on this, and if people, exaggerate.
That's the problem. In other words, people get sometimes a little bit excited over something. They read a story in the headlines, and it gets a lot of national attention. They don't really look at the data. It was probably by now 4 or 5 years ago that I really published a very detailed analysis, statistical analysis, of crime rates among Hispanics in the United States, both legal and illegal, and native-born Hispanics. And there's overwhelming evidence that Hispanics in the United States, whether they're immigrants or not, have roughly the same crime rates as whites of the same age and gender. So, for example, Hispanics who are 25 years old, a 25-year-old male Hispanic has a much, much higher crime rate than a 55-year-old white woman. But, I mean, that's true because of the age and gender issues rather than anything else. And roughly, Hispanics and whites have approximately the same crime rate when you adjust for age and for, gender. So there really isn't much of a Hispanic crime problem at all in the United States. And the proof of it is if you look at cities, for example, the most heavily Hispanic city in the United States is probably El Paso in Texas. And it also has one of the lowest crime rates of any major city. I live in Silicon Valley, and the large city here is San Jose, just south of me. San Jose is about 35% Hispanic, roughly. and it has one of the lowest crime rates in America. So, you know, when you look at all of these very heavily Hispanic cities and you find that they generally have fairly low crime rates, and then you do statistical analysis, correlation analysis between the ethnic distribution of a city and its crime rates, you find out that there's overwhelming evidence that Hispanics and whites have roughly the same crime rates. And in fact, what recently happened is that the FBI finally released, after all these years of prodding by conservative activist groups, they finally released their data showing the rate of crimes as reported by the victims of crimes across different racial and ethnic categories. And just as I'd always been claiming, adjusted for age, Hispanics and whites have very similar crime rates. So that, you know, I think there are all sorts of legitimate reasons to be opposed to immigration, including Hispanic immigration. It causes a huge growth in the American population. We have a drought in California. It also drives down the wages of American workers. That's a very strong reason. But it really is not a good idea to claim that we have to stop immigration because of crime, because it's a false argument. And if you make arguments that are false, nobody believes you about the arguments that happen to be true.
So with the issue of the environment, there's definitely a perception that Republicans are anti-environment. And it is true if you look at California. Like, I live in a very liberal area, Santa Barbara, and they have more restrictions protecting the environment and overdevelopment. Well, places in California that are traditionally been Republican, like Orange County, are more overdeveloped. Would you say that you're more pro-environment than Republicans in general?
Well, I mean, to be honest, I've never thought of myself as an environmentalist. I've never focused much on environmental issues, and, you know, I'm an honest person. In other words, I could say that I'm ardently an environmentalist, but I've never really looked much at those issues. However, one issue that dramatically impacts the environment, and people have known that for decades, is population growth. And America has an extraordinarily high rate of population growth, which really surprises a lot of people when they learn about it. Not only do we have by far the highest rate of population growth of any developed nation, but our population is growing usually twice as fast as that of China. In other words, people think of China having large population growth, but they don't. We're growing twice as fast as China. And the truth is, as you massively increase the population of a country, you obviously cause a lot of environmental problems or other types of problems with resources. For example, California right now has a severe drought. There are many reasons behind the drought, including the fact that we just haven't had much rain for a few years. But one of the reasons is our population is 150% larger than it was when I was a child growing up in Los Angeles. So if you increase the population by 150%, you'll certainly have larger water problems than you would with a smaller population. And that's also true with, in terms of traffic. It's also true in terms of pollution. It's also true with so many of the other issues that touch on the environment. So I really do think once environmentalists start to focus a little bit more on the importance of the population growth issue, which, you know, 40 or 50 years ago was a mainstay of environmental politics, I think some of them might support me on that issue, even though they might disagree with me on other things. One other point I should make is that virtually all of our population growth has been caused by immigration, new immigration, because our existing population has really more or less reached zero population growth or even maybe very slightly declining population. And the reason we're growing at such an extraordinary rate of population compared to every other developed country is because we have enormously high immigration rates, and, you know, that really is a problem.
Yeah, I was going to ask something related to that. I think that the reason why environmentalists in the past could talk about overpopulation was that it basically fell within the politically correct guidelines. And now when you speak about overpopulation, is it true, I mean, that it's basically Hispanics that are causing the growth in America? So it becomes a bit of a race issue, and I think they want to avoid that.
Oh, that's certainly true. I think that's probably the biggest reason that environmentalists have sort of started to run away from the population issue over the last 20 years. Though it's not only, for example, Hispanics. In fact, these days, Asian immigrants are almost outnumbering Hispanic immigrants in coming to the country. So, you know, it's basically different groups of people coming here. But the bottom line is if America takes in 1.3 or 1.4 million immigrants a year, and if the immigrants coming here tend to be relatively young, and once they come here, then they have children, it causes a lot of population growth, and that's really where most of the population has been growing.
Do you think that immigration should be more balanced geographically right now? I mean, prior to the Immigration Act of 65, it was primarily from Europe, and today it is mostly from Asia and Latin America.
Well, I mean, we probably won't be getting much European immigration because the European population is steady or declining. In other words, usually immigration tends to come from countries where the population is rising rapidly or where people are very poor. In most European countries, the people are at least as wealthy as the United States, and also their population is stable, so it's unlikely a lot of Europeans would come here, though, you know, some Europeans certainly come here for economic opportunities. And in general, actually, Latin America, population growth there is pretty much stabilized. A lot of people don't realize, but Mexico's population growth rate, total fertility rate, is down to zero. In other words, on average, the Mexican population is simply replacing itself. It's not growing at all. If you go back 20 or 30 years ago, most Mexican women might have had five or six or even seven children. Now they have two children. So there's no real growth in Mexican population anymore, which is one reason why illegal immigration is so low these days. Now, a few of the smaller Central American countries are still growing rapidly in population, but they're very small, so it's not like a huge number of them are coming here. And in the case of Asia, most of the Asian countries also don't have much population growth. But on the other hand, the Asian populations are so large. In other words, when you have, what is it, 1.4 billion Chinese, even if a very small fraction of them come here for economic opportunities, that's still a large number. So, yes, in general, I think it doesn't hurt to have a balanced set of immigrants coming from different parts around the world. But I really think the main problem is the numbers. I mean, 1.3, 1.4 million new immigrants a year is just too large. And I think if we reduced it down to 500, 600, maybe 700,000, I think that would be a much better approach for the future of America.
You've been involved in a campaign for free college tuition at Harvard. Is this mostly your focus is on Harvard, which is your alma mater, but you also talk about affordable college education in general. Do you agree with Bernie Sanders that it should be completely free, or are you just talking about making it more affordable?
Well, I mean, I certainly agree with Bernie Sanders. I have sympathy for Bernie Sanders' position, but I don't know how practical it is. In other words, to make all these colleges free in America would require a gigantic tax increase to pay for it. And I don't think it would be easy to get a gigantic tax increase through Republican Congress right now. So, you know, it might be nice campaign rhetoric, but I'm not really sure it'll actually happen. My focus is actually something much easier. I mean, Harvard has $38 billion in the bank. It's one of the world's largest hedge funds with a little college or something attached off to one side to keep its tax exemption. It would be very, very easy for Harvard to completely abolish college tuition because it turns out Harvard each year gets 25 times more money from its stocks and bonds and mortgage derivatives than it gets from college tuition. So it will only take 4% of its income to get rid of tuition. If Harvard abolished tuition, and that's why I'm running with a slate of candidates, including Ralph Nader for the Board of Overseers, on a platform to have Harvard immediately abolish tuition. If Harvard abolished tuition, then Yale, Princeton, and Stanford, which are very wealthy and have gigantic endowments as well, would almost certainly follow immediately. All of them would abolish tuition, and other wealthy schools would follow. Now, it's not possible for the public colleges and universities to abolish tuition because they don't have endowments that large, but they certainly would be under a lot of pressure to cut tuition. For example, the University of California system, UCLA and Berkeley, back in the mid-1970s, their entire annual tuition was $630 a year. Now it averages $15,000 a year. $15,000, many, many times more than inflation. I think the reason it's gone up so much is because the universities have felt they had to compete with Harvard and Stanford and Princeton on the quality of the undergraduate life. You know, the dining food, I'm sure, is much better than it used to be. The dorms are nicer. They have Olympic swimming pools. And, you know, I'm sure the physical facilities you have as a student are much better. But you pay $15,000 rather than $600. And so you end up, when you graduate college, being spending 10 or 20 years in debt servitude paying back your student loans. And therefore, I think it would be very important that these universities be under public pressure to cut their expenses and cut their tuition. And the biggest expense, really by far that dominates the reason the costs have gone up so much, is that they've hired so many additional administrators, including very heavily, very highly paid administrators. We're talking about a situation where 20 years ago there was one administrator for every two faculty members. Now there are more administrators than faculty members at many colleges. And so when you've doubled the number of administrators, people who don't even teach, it causes a huge rise in expenses. And I'm sure many of them are nice people. But if we're going to cut tuition at UCLA and Berkeley by 20 or 30 or 40%, we really have to remove some of those expenses, remove some of the costs. We have to cut the bureaucracy, cut the administration, and cut the tuition. And that's what I support.
A while back, you wrote an article titled "The Myth of the American Meritocracy," and you talk about how in Ivy League universities, there's a lot of nepotism for the ultra-wealthy, and basically the point you make is it's gone to the point where it's pretty much gone and almost impossible for someone from a middle-class background to go to one of those universities, even if they get good grades.
Oh, that's very true. I mean, there really is a tremendous amount of corruption in Ivy League admissions right now, and all sorts of different types of corruption. Now, I'm somebody who's always been opposed to affirmative action. I've been opposed to it for 40 years. And so we have all of these affirmative action type forms of corruption where students are admitted because of their ethnic background or what they claim is their ethnic background. Sometimes they pretend to be a member of a group in order to get admitted. And that's wrong. But there are all sorts of other types of corruption. For example, I've really been surprised how many of the students admitted to Harvard and these other elite schools are admitted based on their sports activity. Sometimes, in fact, it's students from very wealthy elite prep schools that have obscure sports that get admitted to Harvard because, you know, they're the only male lacrosse player or something like that, you know, who applies in that group. And then you also have outright bribery. In other words, a lot of wealthy families basically bribe Harvard to get their sons and daughters admitted. And I really think universities should admit people based on their own individual merits without affirmative action and without all these other forms of corruption and bribery. And that's something I would certainly focus on if I and these other individuals get elected to the Harvard Board of Overseers.
Why do you think it's so hard to change laws around things like affirmative action? What keeps them in place?
I think a lot of it is that the politicians are very cowardly about these issues. I think, you know, the truth is, on a lot of points, look, Donald Trump, I'm not the world's greatest fan of Donald Trump, but one reason he's gotten so much support within the Republican Party is that he speaks his mind. He says things in a very plain fashion, and he doesn't back down. Now, sometimes some of the things he says are wrong, but which, you know, is one reason I don't really like him that much. But he still says things that other people are scared to say. So it seems to me on a lot of these issues, all it takes is a small number of people to say what they believe, to not back down, to stand their ground, and then suddenly other people will come forward and say the same thing. Now, you know, take, for example, affirmative action. As I said, I've been opposed to affirmative action for 40 years. I came from a liberal democratic family background. And the single biggest reason I became a Republican under Ronald Reagan was the Republican opposition to affirmative action. But when you look at it, in the last 15 or 20 years, the Republican Party has run away from this issue. They never talk about affirmative action anymore. In fact, George Bush, when he was president, actually advocated what he called affirmative access, which was just the Republican name for affirmative action. So with the Republican Party supporting affirmative action, and with the Democratic Party supporting affirmative action, where do the voters who oppose affirmative action go? They really have no choice. And that's why, you know, that's one of the issues I'm running on. So that if somebody really opposes affirmative action, they can support me, and they know that I mean it because I've been writing on this issue for 20 or 30 years.
Since you brought up George Bush, how crucial do you see it as repudiating the sort of Bush legacy, which includes, obviously, the disastrous Iraq War?
Oh, very much so. I mean, I think Bush was one of the worst presidents we've had in the last 50 or 60 years. I mean, maybe the single worst. Utterly disastrous in foreign policy, utterly disastrous in domestic policy. He just, you know, you couldn't really get much worse than what he did. And on the foreign policy side, you know, like I said, I'm not thrilled about Donald Trump in a lot of positions, but I remember a few weeks ago when he was in the presidential debate and he denounced George Bush for the Iraq War, which he called disastrous. He denounced the lies of the Bush administration. And all the Republican pundits and policy people had a heart attack. They all denounced Trump as being a traitor to the Republican Party, a traitor to conservatives. And a few days later, Donald Trump won a landslide victory in right-wing South Carolina, which is one of the most pro-military states around the country. And that shows, I think there may be a silent majority of Republicans and conservatives who agree with me and agree with Donald Trump on the Iraq War and on all of Bush's foreign policies. And that's certainly one thing I'm taking a very strong position on. And in fact, I'm quite friendly with some of the Ron Paul people. I wrote in Ron Paul's name on the presidential ticket the last couple of elections. And I think if I do well in this race in California, if I end up making it November as the Republican nominee, I would be very glad to use this as a platform to repudiate the foreign wars of George W. Bush, which were also supported by most of the Democrats, which is why I've never considered switching to the Democratic Party.
Also, with this ties into foreign policy and the whole war on terror, what are your thoughts on a lot of the civil liberty and privacy issues like the NSA spying and the Patriot Act?
Oh, it's totally disastrous. I'm utterly opposed to all those policies. And the thing is, it's not just me who really is appalled by it, but people I know. To give an example, one of my old friends, Bill Odom, who was the three-star general who ran the National Security Agency, the NSA, for President Ronald Reagan. He publicly declared the Iraq War as the greatest strategic disaster in U.S. history. He was utterly appalled at the Patriot Act and all of these spying efforts that were put into place, even the early ones before Edward Snowden came out with his revelations. And we're talking about the general who ran the NSA for Ronald Reagan. He was appalled by it. So I think a lot of prominent people quietly are very much opposed to these policies. But again, they're tied in with the Washington establishment. They have a job at a think tank. They want to get on Fox News. And that's the reason they tend to keep quiet on these issues, and I'm just speaking my mind.
Yeah, how bad? I mean, I think, you know, the answer is obvious, but how bad is the groupthink in D.C.? Is it like, if you stray from it, are you banned forever?
It really seems that way. Again, you know, the perfect example is Bill Odom. I mean, there are very few people who have his national security credentials. I mean, he was head of national security policy at the Hudson Institute. He was a professor at Yale. He ran the NSA for Ronald Reagan. And because he was totally opposed to the Iraq War, he was blacklisted from the media. nobody would publish any of his articles that he wanted to submit. Not the New York Times, not the Wall Street Journal, none of these publications, and he was never on the air. And the reason they didn't dare put him on the air is someone with his credibility could have persuaded the members of Congress to oppose the Iraq War. So they basically, they banned him from the media. And that's exactly what really terrifies so many of these public figures in D.C. I mean, it sounds funny, but, you know, I can think of, on certain issues, I can think of a very prominent academic, somebody who has strong connections to, you know, liberal media, somebody who, you know, has strong views. And I actually was told privately what his positions were on certain issues regarding the Ukraine and Russia, and he didn't dare publicly say what they were. I think probably, you know, he's very wealthy. He comes from a wealthy family, so he's not worried about his money. You know, he's a prominent chaired professor at a top university. I think what he was worried about, if he said his true views on the Ukraine and Russia, he wouldn't get on TV anymore. In other words, he wouldn't be on the cable news, he wouldn't be on MSNBC, he wouldn't be on CNN, because the 23-year-old Bookers would cross him off their list. And, you know, it's ridiculous when we have a situation where you have such groupthink that even some of the most prominent and respectable people either are banned from the media or are scared of being banned and therefore don't say what they really believe.
I mean, you could look at James Watson as a...
Oh, exactly.
Perfect example
exactly.
of that, yeah. And, I mean, I think UNS.com in a lot of ways serves as a sanctuary for those who have been cast out of the mainstream. Like, you know, Sam Francis has a ton of, I mean, he's been gone for a long time, but he has a ton of articles on your site. And Rich Wine and Derbyshire, guys that were, you know, famously outed as heretics.
Exactly. I mean, that's the whole reason I set up the website. In other words, gradually, you know, I ended up getting purged myself from the American Conservative, even though I was their publisher. And so it's the sort of thing, since I was purged, I really decided, well, why not set up a new webzine that would provide access to all the other people that were purged? And the nice thing about it is so many different people have been purged over the years for so many different reasons. There are plenty of them to provide, you know, a very substantial webzine.
Have Buchanan and Theodore Coppolis been banned from the American Conservative? Are they still involved with it?
To be honest, I don't read American Conservative much anymore. I think Pat Buchanan still sometimes gets published
there. Yeah, I've seen some things from him on there.
Sure, sure. But, you know, it's usually that they just run a syndicated column or something like that. And I'm not sure about Taki.
Yeah.
He might occasionally have a piece here and there. But Taki, again, has his own webzine, you know, Taki Mag.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You write about the issue of Wall Street and policies towards Wall Street. One thing you advocate is a financial transaction tax. Alex and I, we recently interviewed an independent candidate, Scott Smith, and he made the case that a financial transaction tax, or he calls it a financial settlement tax, would generate far more revenue than the current income tax does.
Oh, that might be possible. It all depends what level you set it at. Now, you know, in terms of actual revenue, it's hard to say, because if you set the financial transfer tax too high, you'll have far few financial transfers. So it's unclear what the elasticity of financial transactions would be. But, I mean, the main advantage of financial transfer tax, aside from generating quite a lot of revenue possibly, is that it would stop this ridiculous game going on Wall Street, where you have all these traders constantly trading their instruments back and forth. It's really a gambling casino. And the gambling casino is really hurt tremendously the American mainstream economy. Now, you know, it just seems, let's look at what makes sense in terms of financial investments. If you're a venture capitalist and you invest money in Google when it was a small little startup company, and you end up making 100 times your investment, the fact that you're paying 1% in a financial transfer tax is totally negligible. It makes no difference at all. It would be 1/10,000th of what you made, and it would be much, much less than your income tax or anything like that. Similarly, if you're Warren Buffett and you invest in a company and hold that investment for 10 or 20 or 30 years, a financial transfer tax would have no impact on you. What it would have an impact on are all these day traders, all these, you know, lightning traders that go in and out of investments in a millisecond to try to buy and sell them. It would wipe all of them out. And I think that would make Wall Street much, much more stable for the ordinary investor. So I don't know exactly what level of tax we should have. And it's sometimes been called a Tobin tax after the Nobel laureate who proposed it probably about 20 or 30 years ago. Usually the Tobin tax proposed has been somewhere in the range of 0.1% or something like that. Bernie Sanders talked about 0.5%. I've sometimes said that, you know, since sales tax on a stick of gum is 7%, maybe a 1% transfer tax would be all right, which is much higher than anyone's ever previously considered. I haven't looked at the details of the issue, so I don't have a particular number in mind. But I do think a transfer tax, a Tobin tax, would be a good thing to consider.
Well, another thing that Scott Smith, who we just in the sort of talking about like changes in economics, he was saying that the Federal Reserve should be made public. Just wondering what your opinions on that would be.
You know, an awful lot of people, including people I respect the opinion of, have very strong views about the Federal Reserve and how harmful it is and how secretive it is. And given all these other things that have come out in the last 10 or 20 years, I'm much, much more suspicious of the Federal Reserve than I would have been, say, 20 years ago. I really have not investigated the issue. And, you know, some of these proposals to audit the Federal Reserve, to force it to reveal all of its detailed holdings, they seem pretty reasonable to me. And so, you know, I certainly think it would be something worth considering, and I'd have to hear the arguments on the other side.
Auditing the Federal Reserve?
Right.
You mean?
I don't know enough about the Federal Reserve to really know what the argument is against auditing it.
The reason why someone like Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, like who they both of them were in support of auditing the Fed, but Ron Paul had this bill, bipartisan bill with Sanders, audit the Fed, and Sanders backed out at the last minute. And I think for Sanders and Warren, both of them were concerned with Republicans having some kind of power over the Federal Reserve if it was made public and open to Congress. So I think, you know, they wanted to do something bipartisan and then tick their party line at the end of the day.
Okay. That's interesting. Again, you know, it seems if we're talking just about auditing the Federal Reserve, it's not obvious to me what the argument is on the other side. But, you know, I'll have to admit, economics has generally been not an area that I focused on enormously over the years. And I don't really know. I learned much more about the Federal Reserve probably in the last five years by reading web blogs and reading columns by people on my own website than I'd ever really known in the past. And so I'd have to hear the arguments on the other side before I formed an opinion. But offhand, it seems like just auditing the Federal Reserve should be a fairly non-controversial position to take, though it seems very controversial in reality.
Would you support bringing back Glass-Steagall?
Yeah, I mean, I think I probably would support it. I just think I'm not sure whether Glass-Steagall, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, was the main reason for the financial crisis. In other words, it certainly contributed, but you had all of these financial institutions that weren't really related to Glass-Steagall that collapsed as well. So it seems to me the biggest problem is that we've allowed Wall Street to run rampant. In other words, we allowed these financial institutions to borrow money at ridiculously low rates and gamble it all. And then we bailed them all out. I mean, the bailout was something outrageous. The fact that Wall Street survived only because of the bailout, and now they're back to their own ways or doing just as better than they ever were doing before, while the rest of the country is still paying for the bailout, is really just outrageous.
So we covered a lot of the campaign issues. We're getting kind of close to the end, but I do want to talk about your plans with the campaign. So right now, you have a little over a month. The primary is June 7th, and I'm in California, so I can vote for you. But what? That's a very limited time frame, and the polling right now is the Kamala Harris is not in the first place, and Loretta Sanchez is second, but you're like a very close third. So your main goal is to get right past her so you can make it into the final round. What are
exactly.
some of your campaign plans? Do you plan to spend a lot of money in advertisement, or do you plan to sort of build up a more like a grassroots campaign dependent on volunteers? And for people like myself who live in California, like what can we do to help?
Okay. Well, I mean, the whole thing is I entered the race very late. So I've been sort of behind the eight ball for most of the last few weeks, just scrambling to put things together. Fortunately, very few Californians have even focused on the race so far. And they've only started really to realize that there's a Senate race in the last few weeks. And during that time, I seem to have gained quite a bit of ground in the polls. And now, just a couple of days ago, we had the first statewide debate, and I think I did really pretty well with that. I took a lot of bold positions, including positions not really usually taken by Republicans. And so I think I really might be moving up. The Republican Party obviously would be embarrassed if the race in November is between two Democrats. And so they certainly would hope that Republicans start to unify behind one candidate. And to the extent that I really end up being the strongest Republican candidate in the next week or two, Republicans might start to unify behind me because I would be their only shot at beating Loretta Sanchez. One thing I should say is even though I've had a successful software business, I'm not remotely as wealthy as some of these checkbook candidates who come along and spend millions upon millions of dollars to run for office and almost always lose. I've put in some of my own money to move the issue forward, to get started. I'm about to start running fairly heavy Facebook ads on a number of issues, basically the minimum wage, raising the minimum wage, cutting immigration, and keeping English in the public schools being three of my most important issues. And there are other issues I'm taking strong positions on as well. I think by taking these strong positions and also by saying that I will only take campaign contributions of $99 or less, nothing over $99, I'm making it very clear that I can't be bribed by all these special interests. And so I'm hoping that I'll be able to raise substantial amounts of money from relatively small donors, just like Bernie Sanders did. I hope I'll be able to get a lot of free media coverage for my forceful and dramatic positions, just like Donald Trump did. And I do think that there's tremendous dislike right now, both among Republicans and Democrats, towards the establishment of their two parties, which is why both Sanders and Trump have been doing so well. And I would think a lot of those voters might lean towards me because in this race you have two establishment, longtime Democratic officials, Kamala Harris and Loretta Sanchez, and then you have two Republicans whose really main career has been Republican Party functionary. They were both former chairmen of the state Republican Party. And then I'm somebody who's an outsider. I've never held elective office. I've never held Republican Party office. I'm saying a lot of strong positions on both the left and the right and the libertarian side. And I think I might do well enough to make it into the general election. And if I do make it past the primary, I think I'll get a lot of attention going into November and a lot of support. And I at least have a shot at beating Kamala Harris and being the next senator from California, running on these sorts of strong issues.
Well, Ron Unz, it's been a really excellent show, and we've covered so many crucial issues. I just encourage anyone who lives in California to check out his campaign and his campaign website.
And that's what I should say. My campaign website is unsforsenate.org. So you can go there. It lists all of my positions. And I'm right now in the process of really setting up a major Facebook operation. But I'll admit I haven't really used social media much in the past. So I only started using Twitter and Facebook fairly recently. But the campaign website is unsforsenate. And you can see all my positions all the articles I've written over the years and where I stand on all these important issues.
It's been really great. I'm a huge fan of your site, and to speak, hearing you speak, it's really great. I'm often very impressed that I can't even gather a good question because you're such a good speaker. So sorry I'm fawning, but yeah, sorry.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Thanks. It's been a great show. That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.
Hey, that sounds great. Thanks a lot.